Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 53, January 6, 2002, The Restoration. Okay, so I'll start with a book announcement. This is one of the books that I used as a reference, Robert Bailey and the Second Scots Reformation by Florence McCoy. It was published in 1974, and I was going to place an order with Powell's Books of Portland, Oregon, and they have one more copy for $10. And so if anyone's interested, I will let me know, and I will first come, first served, and I will, you know, order it for you. No shipping or handling. It'll be just $10. So, okay, then, was that a, I'll take it from?
I will, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I'd like to welcome those of you who are courageously picking up the class during lesson 53, and the rest of you who are just here because Dr. Noel's class finished up. You're welcome too. I thought about this. You know, I knew I was going to have a bunch of newbies, as we say, internet terminology. So I thought I would do a brief review, except for I don't know how. But my last review took seven lessons. But actually, I went to the trouble to work up a two-page review. So maybe I'll just give this as a little overview of where we've come. Or unless you'd all rather just listen to the 52 lessons between now and next week, you could think catch up that way. Okay, so we're picking up the story in 1660, about 100 years after the First Reformation. And although the church, or maybe because, it overcame many challenges during its early years after the Reformation, it flourished during the minority of Mary, Queen of Scots, when they actually overcame military challenges then. Really flourished during her reign. Again, it was there was constant contention between Mary and the church, and also during the minority of James the Sixth, or later James the First, the church pretty much flourished. When James was a young man, age 15 in 1581, he felt the need to subscribe a covenant, variously called the King's Confession and the National Covenant. It was primarily negative in nature. It spelled out in extensive detail what was wrong with papistry. I mean, when I say, you know, a number of very fine print lines on all the things wrong with Roman Catholicism. Significantly, the subscribers, who included the king and a greater part of the nobility and gentry throughout the kingdom, besides swearing their conviction of the truth expressed in the covenant, swore to defend the doctrine and discipline of the Kirk, and swore to defend the person and the authority of the king, as the quietness and stability of the Kirk depended upon the king. This later became the basis of other covenants and reflected, for better or for worse, the Scots' attitude toward monarchy. Right? We're always somewhat puzzled by this. How could they keep, you know, supporting a king and so on? It doesn't really answer the question in one sense. I mean, but they had... I don't think it was merely because they'd sworn to it once upon a time, but the fact that they did swear to it in the way they did certainly reflected their attitude towards monarchy. Which, I guess in 1581, there weren't a lot of alternative forms of government that they could worry about. Okay, as James came of age, he started a long struggle with the church. It waxed and waned over time, and sometimes relations were better, sometimes they were worse. But he was largely successful in exerting control of the church by forcing bishops upon the church, by controlling when the general assemblies of the church could meet and where they could meet. First, the struggle was over bishops. The struggle over bishops was primarily related to the estates and the perks that came with being a bishop. okay, before the Reformation, the bishops, the bishoprics had large estates that came along with them, and during this transition period, there was a lot of wealth to be gained by becoming a bishop or being able to appoint the bishop. Particularly, though, after he became king of England and Scotland, He was more interested in how he might control the church by replacing presbyterial government with episcopacy. In order to do this, he found it expedient to resort to a number of means, including ordering presbyteries to only appoint representatives that he approved to their higher courts, bribing representatives, moving the General Assembly to sympathetic locations, you know, far away from where most of the puritanical ministers were. When convenient, he imprisoned and exiled recalcitrant ministers. Okay, when James died then in 1625, his son Charles I continued in the same path, but perhaps with less sense of what his limits were. Charles had never lived in Scotland, didn't know the Scots nobility, and didn't really know the situation in Scotland, but he was under the influence of Archbishop Laud and thought that he could continue to reform the church after his own heart. He tried to enforce a new liturgy, which was to the Scots very reminiscent of Rome. Okay, it would have followed the sort of high church Anglican view. That resulted in rioting, the famous Jenny Maynes, or Jenny Geddes, supposedly threw her stool at the dean of the cathedral there, and with the saying something like, "Villain, how darest thou sayest mass at my lug, my ear?" That it was just a step too far. It was a step towards Charles's downfall. The Scots took matters into their own hands. They wrote a new national covenant. It was based, the first part of it was the Covenant of 1581. The Glasgow General Assembly of 1638 was the first General Assembly in, I think, 20 years, roughly. It overthrew almost all of James's and Charles' innovations. It deposed and excommunicated the archbishops and most of the bishops, and it asserted their right to hold General Assemblies in the future. Charles, of course, didn't approve of this, and he started the First Bishops' War and then the Second Bishops' War, which militarily were basically non-events. They sort of had one little battle or skirmish, and then it folded. But for Charles, it was just another step on his to his end. They forced Charles to try to... He had to call a parliament. I think he called one twice and dismissed one, but then the next one wouldn't be dismissed. And they, in fact, weren't willing to help him raise any funds to fight the Scots, especially until he'd given satisfaction on other issues. From there, his relationship with Parliament deteriorated to the point that they were in war with each other, the English Civil War. Early on, things looked bleak for the English parliamentary forces, and the English Parliament desperately needed the military aid of the Scots. In order to obtain it, they signed an agreement with the Scots, which is known as the Solemn League and Covenant. And as one observer put it, the English were for a civil league whereby the Scots would provide military aid. The Scots were for a covenant whereby the English churches would become Presbyterian in nature and they would have some uniformity, but along the lines of a Scottish settlement. And there were parties in England that were very sympathetic to that, and then there were others that were... weren't so sympathetic to it. It wasn't necessarily that they were completely opposed to Presbyterianism, you know, altogether, and they were all Arminians. Some were Reformed, but not Presbyterian. Some were very Arminian, and others just had a range of different views. So it was really sort of a mixed multitude in the English Parliament. Once the Civil War had been won, the English conveniently forgot most of their part of the bargain. Furthermore, they imprisoned Charles, and then they later executed him. Okay, this rent a division in the Scots. It wouldn't be healed. Certainly wouldn't be healed during the history of our course. The Scots were very indignant about the English having executed their king. They immediately proclaimed Charles II as king. And after lengthy negotiation, Charles finally agreed to sign the covenants and was allowed to return to Scotland. This put the Scottish at odds with England, particularly since Charles wasn't just satisfied with being king of Scotland. One piece of advice he received at the time was that he should just be king of Scotland and then, you know, negotiate with the English until they were willing to accept him. It's probably, in retrospect, pretty good advice, but he didn't take it. He wanted his complete kingdom. And let's see, the way that this division in the Scots sorted itself out, there were a number of twists and turns, with each party having its turn in power before Scotland was subjugated by England. Prior to that, they each had their turn at being defeated militarily. Actually decimated, and literally close to the literal meaning of decimated, leaving a tenth of the troops. The two parties were the Resolutioners. They supported Charles II because he signed the covenants, still knowing, many of them, that he was really a reprobate. They also wanted to allow into public office and or the army anyone who made a profession of repentance from their malignancy. And this would be the sort of moderate party. The other party was the Protesters or Remonstrants. Usually we'll call them Protesters. They felt that this problem was not that they didn't have enough men in the army, but rather that the army wasn't pure enough. And they opposed any compromise that allowed, we'll say, malignants, people of, either episcopal leanings or ones that just had a very low form of behavior. So, anyways, they felt that this compromise with the malignants was the reason for God's wrath on Scotland. Okay, these Protesters are sometimes called the Radical Party. In terms of ministers, there were approximately 750 Resolutioners and 150 Protesters. So the Protesters were in a significant minority. After their split for 2 years, they held separate general assemblies, and then both sides were ordered to cease and desist to holding general assemblies by the English Commonwealth government. During the remaining years, both sides jockeyed for position, and I don't want to leave you with the impression that that's all they did. They had quite a bit of spiritual work, preaching and so on. But in terms of the history that we're interested in, interested in this, trying to understand this, how they got to the state they're in, and this Resolutioner Protester struggle is an important part. Cromwell died in September 1658, and he was succeeded by his son Richard, who was squeezed between a rock and a hard place, between having debts that he couldn't pay and an unhappy army that was the chief cause of why they were spending so much money. He actually just sort of faded from view. General Monk took over and arranged for Charles II to come back to England to take up his throne. The Resolutioner's representative in England is James Sharp, and he'll come up a lot, but I'll mention him now. He took part in the negotiations. He fooled the Resolutioners into thinking that he was working on their behalf, when really he was negotiating for the overthrow of episcopacy, the overthrow of Presbyterianism and the establishment of episcopacy, with himself conveniently as the Archbishop of St. Andrews. So, there are two archbishops in Scotland when they had archbishops, and that would be St. Andrews in Glasgow, and St. Andrews would sort of be the leading one. Okay, that's my brief review, and for me, that was very brief. Okay, so last time, lesson 52, we left off on the eve of the Restoration, again, the Restoration here being of the monarchy and Charles II to the throne. We quoted at length James King Hewison on the duplicitous dealings of James Sharp. I've already mentioned that he was working for himself and ingratiating himself with the king to overthrow Presbyterianism. Charles arrived in London on the 29th of May, 1660. again quoting Hewison, "That night when the jubilation racket had ceased and the godly were in prayer, bearing up their covenanted monarch at the throne of grace, he first made an oblation of thanks to God in the presence chamber before seeking carnal repose with the arms of the beautiful adulteress Barbara Villiers, who bore him 6 children. He thus early inaugurated England's worst era of lust and falsehoods." Charles was warmly welcomed by both the English and the Scots, or at least by most of the Scots. There were numerous wild, drunken parties on both sides of the border. The people evidently had wearied of living under the Republic, the Commonwealth, and the Protectorate, and were ready to go back to Egypt, figuratively speaking. The Scots nobility, particularly the needy, and particularly the engagers, who I guess I left out in my review, but they were the that was the first part of the division when Charles I was still alive. Some of the nobility tried to make an arrangement by which they would support Charles I, and he would do certain things like allow Presbyterianism in England for 3 years, but it was really a violation of the Solemn League and Covenant. But those particularly made their way to London to meet the new king. They asked that the English garrisons be removed, that their forfeited estates be restored, that was particularly important, and that their privileges be reinstated. Charles appointed a new government. He appointed the Earl of Middleton as his Lord High Commissioner, in other words, the king's representative to the Scottish Parliament, and his generalissimo, the commander of the army. In October of 1650, 10 years earlier, Middleton had been part of a royalist rising, which had intended, apparently, the overthrow of the Act of Classes, by which the engagers were barred from public office. For this, the commission of the General Assembly ordered that he be excommunicated and charged the minister James Guthrie with the responsibility to do so, which is fair enough because Guthrie had made the motion in the first place. We all know how Presbyterianism works in that respect. Well, you thought it was a good idea. Why don't you do it? The king, though, immediately signed an act of pardon and indemnity. He and his committee of estate sent a messenger to ask Guthrie to stay the excommunication. I think the guy arrived on Sabbath morning with a letter in his hand. Guthrie didn't open it, probably guessing what it was. So he pronounced the excommunication. A few months later, Guthrie was to formally decline the king's authority in ecclesiastical matters. But on the 12th of January, 1651, Middleton, I'll say in quotes, repented of his sins. You know, made a profession at church that he was repenting of his sins of being an engager and leading a royalist uprising and so on. And he was allowed back into public office. He was injured and captured at the Battle of Worcester. This is the sort of last battle Charles II fought before in 1652 before fleeing back to France for 8 years. Let's see, Middleton escaped from the Tower 4 months later in his wife's clothing. He took part in another royalist uprising. Well, this apparently was a common ploy, so. Middleton took part in another royalist uprising, the Glencairn Rebellion, and at some point was appointed. During that time was appointed by Charles II, who is now in exile, to lead his forces in Scotland. The rebellion itself was crushed by General Monk, and Middleton slipped away to the continent and joined Charles in exile. Charles appointed the Earl of Lauderdale, John Maitland, right, who comes from the same Maitland family as participated in Mary's government and so on, as Secretary of State for Scotland. Lauderdale had been what we might call an enthusiastic covenanter. He helped to draft the Solemn League and Covenant. He was a lay member of the Westminster Assembly. Then he was one of the Scots nobility who negotiated the engagement. And when Charles II returned to Scotland in 1650, he was at first banned from any public position by the Act of Classes. When the Act of Classes was modified at the very end of 1650 to allow repentant sinners back into public life, that's why Middleton had gone and repented, the Duke of Lauderdale also repented, and took up his position in the army. He was captured at the Battle of Worcester and was imprisoned from 1651 to 1660. Maybe he wouldn't fit in his wife's clothes, I'm not sure. Lauderdale chose Sharp's brother, William Sharp, to be his secretary. Not probably, from the Covenanter's standpoint, the best person to be Lauderdale's secretary. And then to assist Lauderdale and Middleton, James Sharp was another tool of Charles. Okay, as we've discussed, he pretended to represent the Resolutioner wing of the Covenanters while secretly plotting to overthrow them. He was sometimes called the Judas of the Covenant. So the Covenanters, at least the protester wing in particular, but really all of them, are off to a bad start. As we will see, Middleton, Lauderdale, and Sharp all become persecutors of the Covenanters. In particular, Middleton has a personal grudge against Guthrie for excommunicating him. According to Antonia Fraser, who is probably not the most reliable historian, she claims that Lauderdale advised Charles to denounce the covenant publicly, but to leave matters more or less as they were. But apparently Middleton wanted not only to denounce it publicly, but also wanted to enforce episcopacy as soon as possible. The start of the overthrow of the church might be dated with a letter drafted by Sharp and Lauderdale. And to fully appreciate this, I thought I'd quote from Hewison. In the royal closet, the trio, that would be Lauderdale, Middleton, and Sharp, completed a plan, the first detail of which was a letter to be borne by the king to the king's Scottish lieges by Sharp, in other words, the king's subjects. This royal missive, dated at Whitehall, the 10th of August, 1660, signed Lauderdale, was addressed to Robert Douglas and the Presbytery of Edinburgh. Robert Douglas was one of the leading ministers of Edinburgh, a leading Resolutioner minister. The crafty document began by assuring the presbyters that Sharp had loyally executed his mission and fully explained the ecclesiastical situation. It animadverted on some disloyal brethren, of course hinting at the protesters and extremists generally, without considering that Sharp, too, had, as already narrated, supported Cromwell and taken the tender. Now, this tender was this agreement of union between Scotland and England, and a number of people signed it, basically saying they accepted it, and they were later then to say it was disloyal to have signed this, and the people sitting in judgment on, you know, had actually taken it, including Sharp. No mention was made of the covenant. With studied craft, the royal intentions regarding the church were expressed thus: "We do also resolve to protect and preserve the government of the Church of Scotland, as it is settled by law without violation, as well as the ministry living peaceably, as becomes men of their calling." The joyful receivers did not perceive the quirk which Sir George Mackenzie afterwards pointed out. When episcopacy was restored, in this letter objected by the Presbyterians, it was answered that before the restoration of episcopacy, all the acts whereby episcopacy was abrogated or presbyterial government asserted were annulled by the Act Recessory, so that episcopacy, being the only church government then established by law, His Majesty was by that letter obliged to own it. You've got to understand they're definitely dealing with wolves in either sheep or wolves' clothing, perhaps, but definitely dealing with wolves here. The letter further owned the legislation of the Assembly of St. Andrews in Dundee in 1651, promised another assembly, adjured the church courts to attend to ecclesiastical business only, then, as if pointing directly to the protester and anti-prelatist, while stamping out conventicles, the seed plots of disaffection, and invited the church to pray God to give the king fresh and constant supplies of his grace. If the devil ever appeared as an angel of light to the unsophisticated, he did so then in Charles. The jubilant presbyters enshrined the letter in a silver casket. On 3rd September, copies of it were transmitted to other presbyteries. The rude mercenary Middleton, who knew the intention of Charles to establish episcopacy, flouted Sharp for this trick and could never get over its meanness. To Primrose, he spake often of it with great indignation, since it seemed below the dignity of a king thus to equivocate with his people and to deceive them. Sharp, however, somewhat mollified Middleton by declaring that the letter was only a temporary expedient, that the king could be relieved of his promise whenever the existing establishment was abolished. It was, and was intended to be, a base incitement to clerical persecutors. So, the resolutioners were pretty much taken in by this. The protesters, not so much so, but they were small in numbers. The Scottish Committee of Estates was ordered to meet and form a provisional government until the Scottish Parliament could meet. They met in Edinburgh on August 23rd, 1660, and their powers were unlimited. The same day, a number of protester ministers met in order to, according to Hewison, prepare an address of welcome to the king. I don't think that's all they were discussing. But word of this meeting got back to the Privy Council. First, I wondered how the Privy Council heard about this meeting, but it turns out it wasn't done in secret. They had invited a number of people, including resolutioner ministers, so it was no big secret as to how this was done. The Privy Council declared the meeting to be an unwarrantable and illegal convocation, tending to sedition and the rekindling of civil war, and three times ordered them to disperse. When they refused, soldiers were sent to arrest them and seize their papers. Those arrested included ministers James Guthrie and Robert Traill, eight other ministers, and an elder. A few people escaped either by having left earlier, or I don't know if somebody else escaped somehow. The actual document that they were working on has been preserved. This gives you a little better idea of what they were actually working on. And this is from it's a book published by the Free Church of Scotland in the 1800s. It's Lives of Alexander Henderson and James Guthrie. So this is from the life of James Guthrie. It's a little unclear who the author of the life of Guthrie is. It's by the editor, who apparently preferred to remain anonymous. This is an extract from it. We, your majesties, most humble subjects, do, with bowed knees and bended affections, humbly supplicate your majesty that you would employ your royal power unto the preservation of the reformed religion in the Church of Scotland, in doctrine, worship, discipline, and government, in the reformation of religion in the kingdoms of England and Ireland, in doctrine, worship, discipline, and government, and unto the carrying on of the work of uniformity in religion in the churches of God in the three kingdoms, in one confession of faith, form of church government, directory for worship and catechizing, and to the extirpation of popery, prelacy, superstition, heresy, schism, profaneness, and whatsoever shall be found contrary to sound doctrine and the power of godliness, and that all places of power and trust under your majesty may be filled with such as have taken the covenant, and are of approved integrity and known affection to the cause of God. If in a matter that so much concerns the honor of God and the good of this church and your majesty's honor and happiness, we be jealous with a godly jealousy to know your majesty's wisdom and piety be such as will easily pardon it. We note that. Well, no, actually Charles wouldn't so easily pardon it, and this was probably much like sort of waving a red flag in his face. He'd had quite enough of Presbyterianism when he'd been in Scotland for a while and people lecturing to him. Okay, with many of them, the higher profile protesters locked up, not all by any means, but with a number of ones, at least in the Edinburgh area, James Sharp returned from London. Although he claimed in a later letter to have pleaded for the imprisoned Presbyterians, he also showed, as Hewison says, an implacable hatred toward the remonstrance in his letters to Lauderdale, wherein he urged Lauderdale to take extreme measures against the, quote, harebrained rebels. The term wasn't invented in the 20th century. When James Guthrie was petitioning his case, Sharp asserted that Guthrie not only justified the murder of the king, but proclaimed that Scotland's revulsion from the deed was a sin. A little later, he practically recommended to Lauderdale the extinction of these leading impostors, Guthrie, Gillespie, Rutherford, which will daunt the rest of the hotheads who in time may be beaten to sound minds and sober practices. So in Guthrie's case, while Guthrie was defending himself, he actually came in and put a twist on it and made Guthrie, I think, sound, you know, more rebellious than he was. It was to cost Guthrie his life. And he also proposed, I guess he's killing Guthrie, Gillespie, and Rutherford. So the committee estates started to forge fetters for the church. On the 19th of September, all copies of Samuel Rutherford's Lex Rex and James Guthrie's Causes of God's Wrath were called in as poisonous and treasonable. Seems like I read they were sentenced to be burned by the hangman, but I didn't actually find it when I was working here. People who kept their copies would be considered enemies of the king and punished at the committee's discretion. The monuments at the graves of Alexander Henderson and George Gillespie had their inscriptions erased. I always think some of these things, they just seem like such, you know, low-life things to do. We're going to, you know, chisel off, but... Thank you. Of course, it was a different time and a different culture. They put people's heads on spikes. And that wasn't just the bad guys.
Is that like taking keys off the keyboards and things like that?
Yeah, like taking the W off the keyboard. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in those days, I guess chiseling stuff off was pretty much like taking keys off a keyboard, wasn't it? On the 20th of September, the Committee of Estates made a proclamation against all seditious railers. Anyone who said anything against the new administration or who heard and failed to report was punishable. Okay, nice thing about having limitless powers is you can make laws that would otherwise be totally unenforceable or totally unenforceable in any kind of fair, you know, and uniform manner. You know, obviously, if you pass this kind of law, you can be very arbitrary about who you punish. And that was what they had done. In the words of James King Hewison, an unconstitutional inquisition was thus sprung upon the exhausted country. A reign of terror began. On the 12th of October, Lauderdale proclaimed that a parliament to be convened would serve as the final judge of the conduct of the king's subjects. No subject was presumed to go out of the country without license of the Committee of States under pain of being esteemed and pursued as a contender of our authority, said the proclamation. So you couldn't even leave the country without basically convicting yourself of being a contender. When the Parliament met, it was packed with royalists. Again from Hewison. Corrupt officials began to scent fines and forfeitures, while poverty produced many parasites content with the leavings of these persecuting extortioners. To this fact can be traced clearly the motives for the inhuman persecution of the Covenanters. Many landed gentry were summoned before the Committee of Estates and were forced to sign bonds for their good behavior. Bring this up, because this does give also sort of a financial motive for persecuting some of these people. I mean, you always wonder about why things were done, but sometimes they were done clearly with an eye that, you know, we'd be able, these people would forfeit their estates and we'd be, you know, the people in power would be able to claim them. In December, one of the Scots nobility, the man who had set the crown on Charles's head at Scone, Archibald Campbell, the Marquis of Argyll, appeared before Charles. Some people had advised him not to go, and others had, or at least he had some information that he thought that he could go and sort of, you know, apologize before Charles. Argyll led, after the Engagers had been defeated at Preston Moor in 1648, Argyll led the new government that, among other things, had passed the Act of Classes. And after he crowned Charles at Scone, his influence had gradually waned as Charles got the royalists and malignants back in power. Argyll, he'd come to terms with Cromwell, signed the tender, worked some with the Commonwealth government. When he appeared before Charles, Charles had him arrested, thrown in the Tower, and then transported to Scotland, where he was tried for treason. He was called up before Parliament on the 30th of January, 1661. He was tried for a long list of offenses, which... in my opinion, he couldn't possibly have been guilty of except complying with the Commonwealth government, and that seems to be the main thing. And many of his judges had done that also. On the 24th of May, he was voted guilty and sentenced to have his head cut off in 3 days' time, with his head to be placed on the spike that had formerly held Montrose's head. Although they were supposed to receive the king's approval first, Middleton could not wait more than 3 days, and... As Hewison says, Middleton and Glencairn were gaping for the broad acres of Argyll and could not wait. So again, there was this property motive. Magicians. little account. This is a book by J.D. Douglas called Light in the North, History of the Covenanters, but with an emphasis on the post-restoration Covenanters. This is an account of Argyle's death. On the scaffold, the speech which Argyle made was gracious and eminently reasonable. There were no recriminations, no blame cast on particular individuals. "I could die like a Roman," he declared as he left his cell for the last time, "but choose rather to die like a Christian." Addressing the crowd of spectators who had assembled, this proto-martyr of the covenant said, "I was real and cordial in my desires to bring the king home, and in my endeavors for him when he was at home. I had no accession to his late majesty's murder. I shall not speak much to these things for which I am condemned, lest I seem to condemn others. But whatever they think, God hath laid engagements on Scotland. We are tied by covenants to religion and reformation. Those who were then unborn are engaged to it. And it passes the power of all magistrates under heaven to absolve a man from the oath of God. It's the duty of every Christian to be loyal, yet religion must not be the cockboat, it must be the ship. God must have his, as well as Caesar, what is his. And those are the best subjects that are the best Christians." When Argyle stopped speaking, the axe fell. And there's this little comment from James Kirkton, who was a contemporary historian. We find the comment a little unclear. "But as he was a very great support to the work of Reformation," comments James Kirkton, "so it was buried with him in one grave for many a year." I guess he means the work of Reformation, but it's a little unclear. Let's see. Before he was executed, spent quite a bit of time ministers and died, I guess, serenely and with some assurance of his faith. Afterwards, Middleton asked Crawford, one of the other officers, the treasurer, if he believed that Argyle's soul was now in hell. Crawford said, "Not at all. Argyle was naturally a very great coward and was always afraid of dying. So since he heard that he had died with great resolution, he was persuaded that was from some supernatural assistance. He was sure it was not his natural temper." Argyle also had a chance to escape with his wife's clothes, and he turned it down, decided that he would rather die than somehow discredit the things that he had worked for. So he wasn't... Argyle wasn't widely, liked by the protesters wing of the Covenanters either, widely trusted by them. But in any case, he died mainly because Charles didn't like him, probably. Okay, stepping back then, Guthrie was tried before the Scottish Parliament beginning on February 20th. The charges against him included his being the author of the Western Remonstrance. Okay, this was the initial protest to the resolutions. And the pamphlet, The Causes of God's Wrath, for declining the king's authority in ecclesiastical matters in 1651. And writing this, the petition, seized in August the previous year. For the most part, these things were all old news. In fact, he said he didn't write the Western Remonstrance, but of course he did write The Causes of God's Wrath in this petition. Several authors stated that his real offense was excommunicating the Earl of Middleton. Of course, the Earl of Middleton didn't say that, but he was apparently now ready to take revenge. In Guthrie's defense, he pointed out that while many had taken the tender and so on, including his judges, he had suffered for preaching against Cromwell's usurpation. He went on to defend himself very ably in a point-by-point basis, showing how his declinature was legal, both by law and legal precedent. After several delays and continuances, his sentence was announced in April. He was to be hanged at the Cross of Edinburgh. His estate was to be confiscated, and his head was to be placed on the Nether Bow, one of the gates to the city. The day after Argyle was executed, Guthrie's date of execution was announced as being the 1st of June, 5 days after Argyle's execution. So, let's see. Again, from the life of Guthrie, there's kind of a short account of his execution, and what we have is, I think, his entire speech on the scaffold, but we don't have enough time. So, I might just read a little bit of it. There was an account of his last meeting with his wife and with his son Willie, who was 4 or 5 at the time. And let's see. The vindictive rage of Guthrie's persecutors pursued him to the last. As if his life had not been enough, they resolved that he should go to the scaffold bareheaded, and with his hands tied behind his back. And thus it is said that, but for very shame or fear, they would have treated the Marquis of Argyll also. Against this gratuitous indignity, Guthrie earnestly protested, declaring that he was not a thief to be thus shamefully exhibited. He added that if they pinioned his arm, they must also carry him to his execution, as he could not walk without his staff, having the gout in one of his feet. They then made such a compromise in his favor as could have suggested itself only to very small and vulgar minds, for while they would not abate the addition of the cord, it was tied so loosely that he had full use of his arms and his staff. The scaffold was erected at the cross, and the death procession repaired thither from the toll booth, escorted by a guard. When he ascended the fatal platform and had prayed for a few minutes, he went two or three steps up the ladder, but no higher, fearing giddiness in his head, and then made his dying address to the spectators, after which he gave a copy of it sealed and subscribed to his friends to be kept for his son William until he had become older. It was spoken with such an air of alacrity and elevation that it seemed to those who looked on as if he had already been half in heaven. And going further up the ladder, he ejaculated the words of the prophet, "Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine holy one? I shall not die but live." And just before it was turned off, he raised the napkin from his face and cried, the covenants shall yet be Scotland's reviving." Okay, and his speech upon the scaffold goes on actually for 13 pages, but I'll just read you a brief quote. This is from the middle of it, and he covers a number of topics, but he says, "It hath been my lot to have been a man of contention and sorrow, but it is my comfort that for my own things I have not contended, but for the things of Jesus Christ, for what relateth to his interest and work and the well-being of his people. In order to the preserving and promoting of these, I did protest against and stood in opposition unto these late assemblies at St. Andrews, Dundee, and Edinburgh, and the public resolutions for bringing the malignant party into the judicatories and armies of this kingdom, conceiving the same contrary to the word of God and to our solemn covenant engagements, and to be an inlet to the defection and to the ruin and destruction of the work of God. And it is now manifest to many consciences that I have not been therein mistaken and was not fighting against a man of straw. I was also desirous, and did use some poor endeavors, to have the Church of God purged of insufficient and scandalous and corrupt ministers and elders. For these things I have been mistaken by some and hated by others. But I bless the Lord as I had the testimony of my own conscience. So I was and am therein approven in the consciences of many of the Lord's precious servants and people. And however so little I may die desired by some, yet by these I know I do die desired. And their approbation and prayers and affection is of more value with me than the contradiction or reproach or hatred of many others. The love of the one I cannot recompense, and the mistake or hatred of or reproach of the other I do with all my heart forgive. And wherein I have offended any of them, I do beg their mercy and forgiveness. I do from my soul wish that my death may be profitable unto both, that the one may be confirmed and established in the straight ways of the Lord, and that the other, if the Lord so will, may be convinced and cease from these things that are not good and do not edify but destroy." Okay, he goes on to warn them, and I think we'll read a little bit of this. "One thing I would warn you all of, that God is wroth, yea, very wroth with Scotland, and threateneth to depart and remove his candlestick. The causes of his wrath are many, and would to God it were not one great cause, that causes of wrath are despised and rejected of men. Consider the cause that is recorded, Jeremiah 36, and the consequent of it, and tremble in fear. I cannot but also say that there is a great addition and increase of wrath. First, by that deluge of profanity that overfloweth all the land, and hath rains loosed unto it everywhere, in so far that many have lost not only all use and exercise of religion, but even of morality and the common civility that is to be found amongst the heathen. Second, by that horrible treachery and perjury that is the matter of the covenant, the cause of God, and the work of reformation. Be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be ye horribly afraid, and be ye very desolate, saith the Lord. For my people have committed two great evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken his cisterns that can hold no waters. Shall we break the covenant and prosper? Shall the throne of iniquity have fellowship with God, which frameth mischief by a law? I fear the Lord is about to bring a sword on these lands, which shall avenge the quarrel of his covenant. Third, horrible ingratitude. The Lord, after 10 years' oppression and bondage, hath broken the yoke of strangers from off our necks. But what do we render unto him for this goodness? Most of the fruit of our delivery is to work wickedness and to strengthen ourselves to do evil. Fourth, a most dreadful idolatry and sacrificing to the creature. We have changed the glory of the incorruptible God into the image of corruptible man, in whom many have placed almost all their salvation desire, and have turned that which might have been a blessing unto us, being kept in due line of subordination under God, into an idol of jealousy by preferring it before him. Okay, presumably he's talking about the king here, or monarchy. God is also wroth with the generation of carnal, corrupt, time-serving ministers. I know and bear testimony that in the Church of Scotland there is a true and faithful ministry. Blessed be God, we have yet many who study their duty and desire to be found faithful to their Lord and Master. And I pray you to honor and reverence and esteem much of these for their work's sake. And I pray them to be encouraged in their Lord and Master, who is with them, to make them as iron pillars and brazen walls, and as a strong defense city in the faithful following of their duty. Okay, and he goes on then to talk about ones that aren't so faithful to their work. And he makes a number of other exhortations and so on, but we just don't have time. The barbarians are at the gate again. Okay, are there any questions? Mike?
Just a comment in the back. You know, they take away land and things like that. That was just...
Yeah, they actually, even though Guthrie was a minister and didn't have big estates, they also confiscated all his worldly goods. And
really, he was saying goodbye to his family. Imagine giving that testimony, you know, he was saying goodbye to your family, probably wouldn't be out.
Yeah, exactly. So, Mary? Why they were what?
Why did they invite the king back?
Oh, well, the protesters didn't invite the king back, but when he came back, they tried to give this supplication to him. No, General Monk invited the king back. The English were weary of living under a republic, so.
Didn't they say the economy's stupid?
Yeah. Something like that. No, in fact, the resolutioners were sort of suckered by this James Sharp and so on. The protesters, I think, could read the writing on the wall, and that's why one of the reasons why they're gathering to try to plan strategy and so on. But they started with this, again, with this appeal to the king. So, okay. Okay. Robbie, do you want to close this in prayer?